This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome to the Mann Library Chats in the Stacks Book Talk series. In today's talk, originally presented at Mann on June 11, 2010, Professor Drew Harvell presented Out of the Teeming Sea, Cornell's Blaschke Collection. Cornell University is one of a handful of academic institutions in the world with an extensive collection of glass invertebrates created by renowned 19th century glass artists Leopold and Rudolf Blaschke of Harvard Glass Flowers fame. Drew Harvell, marine biologist and Cornell professor of ecology and evolutionary biology, leads the curation and restoration of this extraordinary collection. In a special reunion lecture at Mann Library, Harvell describes the importance of the Blaschke's work to the 19th and early 20th century study of ocean biology, and highlights current efforts to restore the exquisite Blaschke sea life sculptures for permanent display on the Cornell campus.
Thank you all for coming. I realize how precious your time here is, and I hope you're having a wonderful time, and I really appreciate the coming along to this. Has anybody seen the glass flowers at Harvard? Wow, this is a pretty in-the-know kind of audience here. Okay, well, that's a good start. So we have one of the largest collections of the marine invertebrates. And they actually, the Blaschkes did the invertebrates before the flowers. So they kind of learned and were inspired in their start in doing the invertebrates. And then kind of as time wore on, they moved into the flowers. So I'm going to tell you about some of the influences that inspired the Blaschkes, tell you about our collection. So this picture on the left here is one by Goss, and he did this just fabulous works of the British anemones, the sea anemones. So things like these watercolors of all this different diversity of anemones in the tide pools, and then a lot of systematics describing individual anemones. But as was the want for those 19th century natural historians, they were kind of Renaissance people, both artists as well as systematists. And the Blaschkes were really enchanted by some of these watercolors and kind of imitated them. So I'll kind of go through and describe a little bit of that. And then on the right here, these are just a couple of the Blaschke pieces that we have in our collection. So the main part of our collection is in my building. That's in Corson Hall, which is across Tower Road. And I'm excited that today we're going to have a new opening here in the Mann Library, and I'll show you some of the new pieces that we have here. So I'm an invertebrate biologist. I really don't spend as much time curating glass invertebrates as I do working with the live ones. And so it's really interesting to me to see which groups they worked with, why they were inspired to do that. And again, we see the sea anemones, the nudibranchs, which are snails without shells, and the jellyfish. And I think partly that these were the themes that were coming up in the prevailing natural historical times. So the anemones were very much popularized by those fantastic watercolors of Goss. The nudibranchs, as I'll show you, were popularized by the watercolors of Alder and Hancock at the time, and then the jellyfish by Haeckel. I don't have time to go into it today, but we have a lot of correspondence between the Blaschkes and some, for example, Haeckel. So we know that they were exchanging ideas and inspiration. So again, I just wanted to show you, these are some of these just spectacular Goss pieces. And I could look, in fact, I have some in my office. I could look at these all day long. So just to introduce the Blaschkes, this is Leopold and his wife and their son, Rudolf. They began making glass invertebrates in about 1880. By 1888, that's just 8 years later, they quickly learned how to do these. Ward's catalog was displaying over 700 models. That's Ward's catalog in Rochester. And there's a really interesting sort of story of how Ward got back to Ward's through Agassiz, actually, about the Blaschkes, and Ward's decided to start selling these collections to universities. So from the start, they really were intended as educational pieces. So Cornell University bought what was called then the full collection, which is about 570 pieces. And just to give you an idea, this is what that wards catalog looks like. I know you can't read all of them, but you know, each group, I mean, remember there's 570 of these. So each phylogenetic group, for example, the cephalopods, of which this squid is one, they were all different ones that you could choose from. They ranged from about $2 to $5.50, depending upon the complexity of the piece. I mean, it's just unimaginable. So our collection of 570 pieces was ordered in 1885, and we think it was viewed as early as 1882 by Professor A.D. White with advice from Professor Comstock. So this collection really reaches back to the very origins of biology at Cornell. It was rescued from Roberts Hall by Professor Tom Eisner circa 1957. Since he's in the audience, maybe he can tell us. You think about 1957, Tom? Yeah? Probably, yeah. Other than the approximately 200 pieces on display, the rest of this is housed at the Corning Museum of Glass. So we still have hundreds that can be restored and brought back to campus. It's a slow process. They all need to be cleaned, as I'll show you some pictures. A lot of them need to be glued together and restored by glass workers. So this is just an example of one of those anemones. They're just beautiful. And it's fun for students because you get an appreciation of the diversity of the forms within each of these groups. So it's just, I'm going to just run through a few of these. And then I'm going to now talk about some of the jellyfish. And again, I wanted to remind you that Goss's work was very influential. So this is the frontispiece of his Naturalist Rambles on the Devonshire Coast. This is a book that's in Mann Library. One of the exciting things about this partnership for me with Mann is that a lot of the original works are in the library. And so it's really a nice opportunity to kind of combine sort of literary excitement with science, with artistry and natural history. So on the left are some of the beautiful pieces from Haeckel's book. And again, these are just fabulous. And Haeckel was sort of one of the giants of the 19th century in describing the natural history, in naming many of the species, particularly these pelagic forms, which he discovered I wish I could have been there. They traveled the oceans in the Challenger expedition and just brought in the most beautiful, rare forms, many of which are cataloged by Haeckel in these incredible, incredible watercolors. And then this is a Blaschka on the right of a related Scyphozoa. And these are the ocean-dwelling jellyfish that never come ashore. So these are the true ocean voyagers. And this is one from our collection in Corson. These are just a few more. These are, again, some more of what we call pelagic or the ocean-dwelling jellyfishes. So the other thing, as if this wasn't enough, the other really exciting part is that the Blaschkas themselves did a lot of watercolors. So on the left is one of the Blaschka watercolors. And they spent a lot of time preparing and thinking about how to get each piece exactly right. And so before crafting them in glass, they would often do sketches and watercolors. And the watercolors, as you can see, in some cases are as exciting as the glass pieces. I don't know, this is one of my personal favorites, partly because of the biology, partly because I've seen it in the wild and I really love it. It's called a Storomedusan, and it's closely related to that ocean-living pelagic jellyfish I just showed you. They're both what we call scyphozoans, but it's attached. So it's a jellyfish that's attached on the bottom. And it's really, I like it because it's kind of a transitional form evolutionarily between the pelagic members of this group and the attached members, which are the anemones or the corals. And this is just a picture I took a couple of summers ago in the Pacific Northwest, where I found this live one in a tide pool. They're just very beautiful. So this is a picture from Alder and Hancock's book of their nudibranchs, and this is actually a picture from a book in the library. No, I didn't actually cut out the picture in the library. Mary doesn't let me do that. They actually barely let me touch them, but in fact, I didn't even take the picture, but they were kind enough to bring them out, let me look through them, and take the pictures for me. So this is what the Alder and Hancock watercolors are like. And it's probably, one of my graduate students reminded me, it's a good idea to tell people what a nudibranch is because it's not something you run into all the time out here. Nudibranchs are snails without shells. And so they're perfectly good animals. So they have mouths that run into a digestive system. They have antennae for sensing. And they're predatory. Okay, so these are really the lions of the ocean. Some of them aren't very big, but some of them do get very large. And they're almost entirely carnivorous, so they're eating sponges, anemones. Some of them are pelagic and they eat jellyfish. And they also have these little diverticula, that's what we call it, diverticula, little pieces of the digestive system that go into those beautiful projections on the back and load chemicals and defenses into them. So even though these snails don't have shells, they're very well defended by both chemicals and stinging cells from their prey. And they're really an enchanting, gorgeous group. So these are some of the Alder and Hancock drawings in their systematic works of these nudibranchs. And you can see there's a fabulous diversity of them. And this one's a little hard to see with the lights on in here. But these are a series of the nudibranchs we have in our case in Corson Hall. And there's also going to be some in the new case here that you'll be able to see. But in the wild, these are just fabulously colored. Lots of bright colors, yellows, blues, oranges, spots, stripes. These are just outrageous creatures. And a lot of the coloration is, we think, warning coloration. Because, again, remember I said they're uptaking a lot of the quite toxic chemicals from their prey. And fish won't eat them. This is just one of the pelagic. This is starting to be something rare. I've never seen a nudibranch like this. This is one of the pelagic nudibranchs. And then these are the watercolors the Blaschkas did of it before actually crafting the work in glass. And these watercolors are courtesy of the Corning Museum of Glass. And that just reminds me again, you know, this long story, I've been at Cornell for about 24 years now, and it's just been an interesting series of really adventures in bringing this collection back to Cornell, and it certainly has involved an important partnership with Corning as well as others here in the audience. Again, this is one of the nudibranchs. I thought you might enjoy seeing what they actually look like when they're alive, so my grad student and I made this video last summer when I was teaching a course at Shoals Marine Lab. So this is Flabellina, which is a very common nudibranch at Shoals. It's only about that big. But if you look closely, that's what they look like as they're cruising around looking for anemones and other prey to eat. That's all it does. So one of the things we've done with this collection is, remember, these pieces were all made and named in about 1868. And so you can imagine, scientists being the way they are, a lot of these names have changed probably several times since then. And so my colleague Jim Morin really got interested in trying to sort of do some detective work to figure out how many of them we could, you know, get the real names on. And of course this is important because this is the first step and figuring out how many of these we still have in the wild, or whether some of them have gone extinct. So Jim and I together, you can't see this picture, but there's Jim and I'm up here somewhere, ran a seminar course. These are a bunch of our Cornell students, and the students did the research work to rename some of these pieces. And I just wanted to recognize a couple of the students. This is Sarah Fitzpatrick and Mike Grundler. And I don't know, does anybody know John Fitzpatrick? He's the director of the Lab of Ornithology. Yeah, well, this is his daughter. And we were so lucky to have her because she's brilliant. And so Sarah and Mike took on the nudibranchs. This is a huge list of the ones that they researched, and you don't need to be able to see those. The top one, I can't even read this, was originally named Aeolus militaris in the original description. And in their research, they found out it still exists, but it's called Phidiana militaris. It's in the order nudibranchia, it's a nudibranch, and it's from Australia. And these are the pictures of it. And we have the glass one in our collection. Another example, this one's an actually more interesting one for us, is Dendronotus, arborescens was the original name it came with. And that's now been renamed to Dendronotus frondosus. That one lives at Shoals. So this is what it looks like here. And this is what it looks like in the video that we took that same summer. We can get it to move. There it is. So this is the Dendronotus frondosus from Shoals Marine Lab, and that's what it looks like. And it looked about the same to the Blaschkas when they did it 140 years ago. They made the glass replica. Again, it's a carnivorous nudibranch. Feeds on relatives of anemones. And then finally, because everybody likes echinoderms, this is a brittle star, an ophiuroid. This is the actual piece in our collection. And then this is sort of the closest we could come to the ones that we found when we were at Shoals Marine Lab. There's very few, actually, echinoderms. This phylum is called the echinoderms. And that's because these are relatively hard-bodied. The Blaschkas did an amazing thing. They picked very difficult-to-study organisms, things that were soft-bodied, like anemones and jellyfish, things that students couldn't see because if you preserved them, they just turned into a colorless ball of mush. Things that, you know, really needed to be preserved in glass. And so they didn't actually, we don't have that many of the brittle stars because, of course, they preserve quite well. So the work of restoring this collection, you know, part of the story of how this has all worked, how we've even been able to bring any of these back to Cornell, is our glass worker. This is Elizabeth Brill, and I ran into her when I was doing field work in the Bahamas, and she was running an Earthwatch program, and we got talking about glass because she had all this beautiful glass jewelry. And one thing led to another, and it turned out that she was from Corning and knew how to restore glass and knew all about the Blaschkas. So she's become our glass restoration expert. And through us, she's now moved on and is restoring many of the other Blaschka collections. So there's one at the Boston Museum of Science. She's now helping Harvard restore their invertebrates, and she's worked in Edinburgh as well. So this is very difficult work. All of these, this is an example of our Holothuria, which is a sea cucumber. And this is what it looks like when she finds them in their boxes. This is actually a good one, because it's intact, but it's just covered with dust and dirt. So all of them need at least this. Some of them, this is one of the new one, Histiotuthis rupelii, and she found it like this, so the tentacles are broken off. All different parts of it are, as well as dirty, just broken up. And so she cleans them up, puts them back together, and then we have them on display. This is one of the new ones. This one really took my breath away when I saw it. I should say that we're lucky that we have this new collection. It was just moved in last week. So it was really done just barely in the nick of time. This is a siphonophore. It's again one of those open ocean forms. This is something that can only be collected by scuba diving or snorkeling. If you try to collect this in a net, all of these pieces just fall apart from the live organism. This again is a predator, okay, it catches fish. So all of these bulbous tentacles here are loaded with stinging cells, and it sets these beautiful huge nets. A fish swims into it, its toxins are injected into it, and then the siphonophore eats it. These are the swimming bells, so it actually can swim quite directionally up and down and side to side. It responds to light and temperature gradients in the open ocean. And we have this one in the case here that you'll be able to see. And I just included this sort of a schematic of what this looks like. So this is the pneumophore, which is a gas-filled float that keeps it afloat so it doesn't sink. And then these are the swimming valves that actually pulsate and swim. And we have a video over by the case so that you can actually see how this thing swims. One of the other remarkable parts of this is its size. So this is a diver. I found this online at ClickPick. This is a diver, and these are all the lower parts. So if we stretched the entire organism, it would stretch all the way across the room from the swimming bells with the fishing parts. So this is an enormous creature. And of course, the Blaschkas had to cut it off somewhere. They couldn't fill the room with it. So they did the best they could to indicate that this really was quite elongate. And so I urge you to look at the video that we have in the other room, because it's really fun to watch it moving through the water. These are a couple of the other new cephalopods that are in our case. So these are a squid and an octopus relative. This is another group that the Blaschkas really loved. So we actually have quite a few of these cephalopods in the collection. I mean, this one just amazes me. If you look at this, I mean, they've captured the texture of what the skin actually looks like on this octopus. And there's a bigger version of it over there. A couple of things about my perspective on this collection. Kind of four ways as an educator we use the Blaschka collection. Our cases display some of the rarest and most fragile of ocean sea creatures. So these are things I've never in my career seen, some of these. Certainly not that siphonophore, not a lot of the cephalopods. Many of these are very rare. And it's exciting to have them there on a daily basis that our students can see. Our students also use this collection to study taxonomy and the science of naming invertebrates. So as I said, many of these names have changed, and it's a really nice project for some of the students to go back through the historical works and trace those name changes. And eventually we'll use this to investigate how many of them are still extant. For me, these invertebrates remind us that marine biodiversity is just so very fragile and diverse. And from the work I do, a lot of our marine biodiversity is threatened by climate change. This was a poster from a science cabaret I did this year, and I was asked to do a talk that combined talking about the Blaschkas with conserving marine biodiversity. And I just really liked the way they framed this, that these are both very fragile, both our glass pieces and the actual marine biodiversity which inspired them. So I guess I would just say our biodiversity is at risk as never before. We're having a combination of climate change and human population increase that's really delivering a knockout punch to both our tropical and temperate oceans. In the tropical oceans, the temperature warming is an enormous threat. A lot of my research involves the effects of this temperature warming on biodiversity. And in the temperate oceans of the Northwest, we're starting to see pretty serious effects starting from acidification, which is another effect of climate warming. And then that's to say nothing of oil spills. So these are sort of ever-present threats. I just wanted to add, in my lab, if you wonder what it is I do, actually, the Blaschkas are wouldn't be right to say it's recreation, but in a way it is. I absolutely adore working with this collection. My own research has to do with coral invertebrate interactions, the sustainability of coral reefs. And, for example, about a third of coral species are thought to be threatened with extinction. And this is sort of our CFAN, which is one of the lab rats in my lab, and we study this purple area here, which is the immune response of the CFAN, so how it fights back, in this case, against a disease. No, it's highly endangered. So I want to end with some thanks. This has been a true partnership. I think I might want to start at the bottom and thank Paul Feeney, who was the chair of my department when I came to Cornell, and he's really the one that kind of launched me on this whole expedition. One day I came into his office and he said, "Do you know anything about these Bloschke invertebrates? It says here they're on, you know, permanent loan to Corning. I wonder if they could come back to Cornell." And that was sort of the beginning. We went down to investigate, and turned out they could come back to Cornell, and we've kind of been working on it ever since. I want to acknowledge their help in bringing this new collection to Mann Library. They provided a very generous gift that allowed us to restore cases and restore this part of the collection, so it's kind of a continuing partnership. Pretty much everybody on this list has been involved in really fundamental ways. Mann Library has been an absolute delight to work with ever since Janet McHugh really pushed bringing part of the collection here to Mann Library. Evelyn Ferretti has been involved every step of the way in helping just with everything to try to make this happen. Mary Oakes as well has been continuing supportive and enthusiastic about this. Liz's artwork is really exciting as well. Elizabeth Brill, I've already talked about her. She's our glass worker. Bill Warmus is another glass enthusiast and photographer that's been involved. And of course, Tom Eisner, who found the collection and saved it from being sort of left in pieces on the floor in Roberts Hall when it was about to be moved, and safely shepherded it to Corning Museum of Glass.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.